1039 1450 WKXL NHTalkRadio.com. We welcome you to Feldis and Kale, and we are proudly presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. It's Ken Kale and Dan Feldis. And Dan, how are you today?
I'm good, Ken. How are you?
I'm doing well. Our contract renewed again.
Surprisingly.
To the surprise of thousands. We are back for another program, and our guest today is State Representative Chris Schultz of Concord and Merrimack County District 18. Chris has been a dedicated community organizer and progressive activist for over 30 years. She must have started when she was two. She has worked as a consultant in political campaigns in New Hampshire and around the country for candidates running from positions from mayor to president. And Chris, welcome to Feldis and Kale.
Thanks for having me.
It is our pleasure indeed. So,
Chris, thank you so much. And one of the many issues that you've worked on is the minimum wage. You've been the leading advocate on it at the State House over the last few years, the fight for $15 an hour for working class folks. Can you tell us a little bit about that effort, where it stands, and just fill our listeners in on where New Hampshire is in this fight?
Great. I'm happy to talk about it. Doesn't the phrase, this is how I love to start talking about, the phrase working poor is the worst oxymoron I've ever heard. We need to get rid of that phrase. Anybody who's working hard should be rewarded for their hard work, and their value should be appreciated. Right now, New Hampshire defaults to the federal minimum wage, which puts us on par with states that have a much lower cost of living, like Mississippi and Alabama. New Hampshire is an expensive state to live in, and our workers definitely need a raise. Compared to the states around us that are already on a path towards 15, Maine workers make $12.15 an hour right now. Vermont is $11.75, and Maine is $13.50, and they're all on a path to 15. And New Hampshire workers are stuck at that federal level. We need a raise desperately. And the folks who typically make a minimum wage in New Hampshire are 35 years or older. They have one out of three of them have young kids at home. Almost a majority of them work full time. They're essential workers, frontline workers who are caregivers for our sick, elderly, and people with disabilities. They're child care workers. They're frontline service workers. So the folks that during the darkest days of COVID that we were clanging our pots and pans and holding up signs to thank, that's who we're talking about in part, are these folks who've been working hard for not a wage that can sustain them and their families here in New Hampshire.
Well, certainly at $7.25 and defaulting, we don't even have our own state minimum wage. And there's been efforts at the State House. You've been leading those efforts to reestablish the state minimum wage and raise it. Can you give listeners a little bit of an update of where we're at? Obviously, those were not successful, but can you give listeners an update?
Yes. Right now, the $15 minimum wage bill that I am the lead sponsor of in the House is on hold. The Labor Committee will be taking it up over the summer and fall and be bringing it to the floor in January, right around the time that we hear where the other states around us are going up the next step on their ladder towards 15 while we stagnate. And I encourage folks to talk to their legislators. Call the governor, who's vetoed every minimum wage bill that's come past his desk. But I also want to point out that one good thing that is happening is there is the possibility at the federal level. I'm happy that it would succeed for all Americans. It's called the Raise the Wage Act. It would raise the federal minimum wage over step. to 15. It would also end the sub-minimum wage for tipped workers, which is currently at the federal level $2.13 an hour. New Hampshire workers, tipped wage workers, actually get $3.26 an hour, so which is really hypocritical of us. But it would also raise the wage for people with disabilities and youth who make a sub-minimum wage as well. So the Raise the Wage Act at the federal level, because Democrats are in the White House and in Congress, we have a shot to pass it for the whole country. But we're working hard to make it happen here in New Hampshire, too.
But I'm sure you've heard the arguments from the other side that perhaps this $15 minimum wage could eliminate a number of jobs.
Yes, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I'm very happy to talk about that. Because when you look in the communities across the country that have already raised the wage and are already paying $15 as a minimum wage across the country, I will say at the beginning, for a short period of time, there is a bit of a flux in the economy, but then it rebounds. And the communities that have raised the wage to $15 an hour already were booming and have been booming and have recovered from the difficulties during the pandemic far more quickly than the areas that don't have it. And then two other big points I'd like to raise to anyone who wants to push back on paying workers a better wage is, what do we think of the value of hard work and responsibility? You know, I remember hearing that from Republicans for a long time, and I don't hear it anymore. And that's because we aren't paying workers a living wage, or we're not valuing their hard work. And this shows up in how workers feel about their work. Majority of American workers don't feel that hard work really matters to them, because it isn't being rewarded for their own hard work, isn't being rewarded when they can't pay to live. In New Hampshire, the second point I wanted to make, if you go to the living wage calculator that MIT has, the average family of three, two parents and a child in New Hampshire needs $61,000 a year to live in New Hampshire for just the basics. We're just talking transportation, childcare, food, you know, having a place to live. And, you know, if you live in a place like Portsmouth, it's even more difficult. And what's really amazing is, you know, for all the talk in Concord, for all the talk in D.C., if you ask the average Granite Stater, do you want a $15 minimum wage? Do you want to get rid of and end the sub-minimum wage level? The majority of Granite State voters support this. A majority of Republican Granite State voters support this. So the average person who lives in sort of, I guess you could call it the real world, you know, already understands this at a really basic level, because we should reward hard work with the ability to live and pay the basics in our society. It just seems like a no-brainer to me.
And of course, more money in people's pockets means more money in the economy, circulating the economy, especially a consumer-driven economy, which we have.
Yes.
In the United States, particularly in New Hampshire. And so a recent study came out in terms of housing costs and the ability to afford housing. How does minimum wage link up with the ability of families to get and keep housing?
Impossible.
Yeah, yeah.
In short, it's impossible. There's no way you can get the basic rental unit anywhere in New Hampshire. It's also very hard to get one right now. But low-wage work in general, not even the minimum wage, but, you know, higher than the minimum wage even, makes it near impossible, if not impossible, to get a basic rental unit anywhere in New Hampshire. It's impossible.
And obviously that's a big issue in New Hampshire as well, is the vacancy rate is less than 1%. Rental costs are, no pun intended, through the roof. So these frontline workers, in particular, grocery store, et cetera, that are making maybe not the minimum 725, but maybe the 8, 9, or 9.5, are still not able to do it when they're working full time and Absolutely. Fulfilling that value, as you mentioned, of work. And so rewarding the dignity of work and rewarding the efforts for all of us, in many cases, especially with frontline workers, to be able to provide for their family and for themselves is a central point to that. And so what has been that central point that I just mentioned, that you've mentioned, Chris, that mm-hmm. you've talked about? What has been the response from some folks on the naysayer end of it about reestablishing and raising the wage? What do they say about those workers who are unable to provide for their family? What do they say?
Nothing. I feel like it's a lack of empathy. But I will say the market forces, at least at the level of, say, the people who run the Target Corporation, they're already paying the lowest wage at their store is $15 an hour. So the market needs to reflect the needs of the workers. You know, when I hear, just basically nothing from to answer your question, I hear basically nothing to answer that point whatsoever. And from folks in Concord that don't want to pass this bill or want to strangle the wage in general. Because, by the way, I forgot to mention, there was a bill that passed that would freeze our sub-minimum tipped wages to where it is now, regardless of what happens at the federal level. I don't know if it's gone to the governor's desk yet or not. I don't believe he signed that yet or if he's indicated if he will or not, but I hope that he vetoes that. But absolutely, we need to think, not even just empathically, but like your point, every dollar paid to a low-wage worker stays in our community because folks that earn less than a living wage, they have to spend all of their money to just, you know, not even meet the basics, essentially. And raising that wage, all of that money stays in our economy right here in New Hampshire. And it would actually benefit the state economy to raise the wage.
Our guest on this edition of Feldes and Kale is Chris Schultz of Concord, a state representative out of Merrimack County District 18. We will continue with Chris right after these words. Feldes and Kale, 1039 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com, presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. Welcome back, Feldes and Kale, and we are joined today by Chris Schultz of Concord, state representative out of Merrimack County District 18, and we're talking about the raise of the minimum wage in New Hampshire, ultimately to $15. So would it be done in an incremental way, Chris?
Yes. I think even Bernie Sanders' bill at the federal level reflects steps to getting to 15 so that employers can adjust, and that seems the fairest way to do it. And my bill would get to 15 by 2025, and that's the same as the federal bill.
That's the same as the bill actually that passed in the U.S. House of Representatives, correct?
That's correct, yes. And I have to say thanks to Dan Feltes because he helped me write the first bill and really was a big contributor to the whole discussion and effort to raise the wage. And so it's great to be with you, Dan.
Well, it's always great to be with you too, Chris, and great to work with you on this and so many other issues. And, you know, certainly in a prior life, working as a legal aid attorney, including managing the Housing Justice Project, protecting people from foreclosures from Wall Street banks during the Great Recession, and helping mm-hmm. tenants get by and helping families get by. I saw this front and center where folks were working but not getting paid enough. And then they got into situations where they couldn't afford the place where they live, sometimes lost their home. In addition to that, one of the things that happens is sometimes folks apply for assistance and and that's public assistance, and they have a right to do that. But what's happening in some cases is taxpayers are subsidizing basically the low wages of some of these big corporations.
Absolutely.
And so if you can speak to that a little bit, and what is the counter argument? What are the naysayers of reestablishing or raising the minimum wage say to that argument?
That is an excellent question. You know, Walmart is easily one of the companies that we can point to. They take tons, I unfortunately don't have the figure in front of me, but they take a lot of New Hampshire state money for various contracts and for corporate development money, for sure. And then they teach their workers how to apply for assistance. So instead of paying their workers what their value ought to reflect, they're sort of squeezing it at both ends. So when a worker works full-time for Walmart and makes a sub-minimum wage and can't afford to do the basics for their family, they do qualify for state and federal assistance, and that is taxpayer money. I would rather Walmart do the right thing, pay them the money that their value should reflect. And, you know, unfortunately, there's also a stigma that comes with working full-time and needing to go on assistance. It's really, I think, a moral issue on that level. You know, the sort of negative feelings that a family feels, because anyone who's working hard absolutely does not want a handout. They're working hard and doing what society is asking of them. And absolutely, companies like Walmart should not be getting any assistance from the federal or state government in any way if they're not contributing to our economy by paying their workers a decent wage. And then that they go on public assistance as just something that shouldn't be happening. And so, you know, the notion of working poor should be something that Republicans and Democrats easily should want to work together and end. You know, I feel like quoting Ronald Reagan randomly. I mean, pull out any quote that he ever said about the value of hard work. Where has that value gone with the Republican Party? You know, I think that should be a common ground that we can find, that anyone works full-time in New Hampshire and isn't rewarded for that hard work with the sort of pay that they should be earning. It's just absolutely, I don't get it. I don't get it at all.
So again, tell us how it would work with, you know, my primary concern would be the restaurant industry and the impact it would have on them in particular, especially, you know, a locally owned and operated restaurant, a mom and pop operation, if you will.
Sure.
So how does it work in that scenario?
Well, I've talked to restaurant owners that say that paying workers more actually has been better for their restaurant. There's a New Orleans themed restaurant in the town of Pembroke, for example. The owners have really been very enthusiastic supporters of raising the wage. And I think that when employers see that it adds value, and they have more customers right here in our community, I think they see that it's a benefit to them. It's like anything that is driven by fear, and in this case also driven by a concern over profits, maybe some greed, I don't know. But, you know, I don't mind the question being asked, because we should be thinking of how capitalism is in this economy. And capitalism should then be looking at the wages of workers and adjusting at this point. You know, whether it's the sort of anxiety of coming out of COVID, and people are still kind of touchy, kind of rude to, you know, service workers. And it's really hard to be a frontline worker right now. And that's why you see a lot of restaurants there having a difficulty finding workers. I say raise the wage. you know, reward your workers for the value of their hard work with a decent, you know, minimum wage.
So I think one of the things that you heard about Senator Sanders' bill, which is different than the bill that you and I worked on at the state level, was the basically lifting it entirely for tipped workers. And I think you heard that the concern about the impact on the restaurant industry from Senator Shaheen as a basis to vote no on Senator Sanders' legislation. What kind of response would you provide to that with respect to Sanders' legislation?
Well, I think that, you know, it's just really interesting if you go to the history of, like, why do we even have a sub-minimum wage in the first place? You know, tipped wages is something that's existed in Europe for a very long time. But if you look specifically at the history of wages in America, the sub-minimum wage actually has roots in racism. And in the slavery era, as we came out of Reconstruction, the post-slavery era, tipped wages were put in place at a sub-minimum wage as a way to basically continue making sure that folks who were no longer slaves weren't empowered more. I mean, fact checkers have looked into this, and it's true. There's actually racism rooted in the whole concept around the so-called right-to-work laws as well, and Martin Luther King Jr. was very involved in all of that. So this is a relic of the slave and racism eras of America that really we need to abolish both a sub-minimum wage and, obviously, I oppose the so-called right-to-work legislation that, you know, as well. But that we know that the history behind this has a root in continuing sort of sad relic of slavery and racism. It's just, why do we, I want to counter with saying, why do we want to continue that? There's nothing about it that makes sense in a modern economy where we are supposed to be valuing diversity and, honestly, everybody's dollar.
Yeah, and that's provides a that discussion and the roots of that to provide a pretty smooth segue into another issue that you've led on. You've led the charge. You were on the committee, the House committee, that first heard the so-called divisive concepts legislation, House Bill 544, which ultimately became part of the state budget, which bans, in certain contexts, discussion of systemic inequality. Can you, for listeners, talk about that fight that you led at the committee level, what the legislation actually does and its impact now that it's passed as part of the state budget?
Right. It's so insane. It's a made-up issue. The so-called divisive concept, it is about a teaching around diversity and inclusion that really was only talked about at law schools and not even all law schools. And it was simply a take on actually something that all diversity inclusion education touches upon, and that's the notion that, you know, we all have inherent biases. So, but the version that this legislation that's in the budget in this past is really about censorship. It doesn't believe that Granite Staters have the courage to talk about difficult topics like race that can make us feel a little uncomfortable if we're white. You know, and it's not anything that really is a real concern. But it's saying it takes this one very narrow thing and tries to say, okay, this thing that has happened in some law schools, I don't even believe in New Hampshire, we then, therefore, don't want to have any discussions of race because, wrongly, they say it teaches white children how to be racist. No fooling. That's one of the biggest arguments they used to pass this out of my committee. And, of course, I voted against it. But really, saying now, so it takes that little, this one line of thought in the whole teaching of at law schools and says, okay, because this is a difficult concept, we don't want this in our school. We don't want diversity and inclusion education in our schools. We don't want it in anything regarding state trainings. So this means we can't talk about inherent racism and how it might be a difficulty in employer-employee relationships, in peer relationships that, you know, it's through employment. It's, you know, has implications in schools to say, can we even really talk much about what MLK Day is anymore? Can we talk about the history of slavery and how remnants of that, like the discussion around the so-called right to work or subminimum wage? There's a direct line of history that continues to today. Can we even talk about that history? You know, Keene State has a renowned school on genocide studies so that by understanding that, we don't repeat that and have genocide anywhere on Earth today. They're concerned that it will impact them, that they can't teach even the basics around World War II and anti-Semitism at Keene State. So absolutely, they're trying to censor discussions that are difficult or uncomfortable.
And, of course, in response to Governor Sununu endorsing and signing this, 12 of the 17 members of the Diversity and Inclusion Council, his own council, resigned in response to him endorsing and signing this, and also rejecting multiple times, Governor Sununu rejecting the concept of systemic racism even existing. And by the way, systemic racism existing doesn't mean that each and every person within a system is inherently racist.
Exactly.
It means that the system has created, for whatever reason, disproportionate impacts based on race and color.
Yes.
And so just acknowledging that that exists is a pretty simple task, I think. And but that has been rejected repeatedly by Governor Sununu, and his rejection of that and the signing of this piece of legislation has led to that Diversity and Inclusion Council, 12 of the 17 members resigning. What's your response to the resignation of more than half of that council?
Well, I think it speaks volumes. And I think what is just so maddening to me is, we Granite Staters are tough. You know, Granite in and of itself, we're Granite Staters. We are a tough group of folks. And it says, and it assumes that we don't have the courage to talk about things that maybe are a little uncomfortable. I think that this is just playing to the worst elements in politics, to take the sort of racist relics of the Trump era and trying to pander to that relic of the Trump era for continued positive political gain. And that, to me, is just disgusting, you know, that we don't, but just to even say, for the average Granite Stater, really, we don't have the courage to talk about these things? I mean, I know people talk about them at the kitchen table, you know, and across the state. We absolutely have the courage to have these conversations, and then to try to censor them on top of that, it's just really absolutely maddening.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to toil and struggle to create a more perfect union, you got to recognize the imperfections, and censoring discussion around them is just not the New Hampshire way.
Yeah, and it's a huge step backwards, too. You know, I thought it was actually one of the things I liked about Governor Sununu when he created the council, you know, and it came out of response to Black Lives Matter, but I think he's unfortunately more than negated a lot of the things that actually were once positive. With this, it's like 20 steps backwards. Absolutely.
Well, Chris, next time you're on, I want to delve into the five different kinds of chilies you make. you know?
What's your
I would love that.
What's your favorite chili?
I love the Cincinnati chili that comes with spaghetti.
Oh, I love that, too. I have a friend who makes that, and it's great.
Cincinnati. Me. You have another friend. Me, too.
Yeah. Well, you got two friends. I have two friends that make it. That's great. I'm a fortunate person.
Oh, yes, Chris, you are.
Chris, thanks for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Chris.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Take care. That is Representative Chris Schultz of Concord. And we will talk with her again in the future. But coming up, we're going to be having a discussion with Amy Hall, who is the executive director of Granite State Dairy Promotion. And that's the sponsor of this program, Feldis and Kale at 1039 1450 WKXL, nhtalkradio.com. We are presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. nhtalkradio.com. It is Feldis and Kale, and it's a delight to have you along with us. We have been renewed once again, and we are presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. And ironically enough, as I get those words out of my mouth, the executive director of the Granite State Dairy Promotion is on the line with us right now, and that would be the one and only Amy Hall. Amy, how are you today?
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well. Doing very, very well. I had a little chocolate milk this morning, actually.
Good.
Before I
did you have grilled cheese too?
I did not. I did not. I had a cinnamon raisin bagel with cream cheese.
Oh, that sounds great.
That's what I had, and chocolate milk.
Amy, what did you have for breakfast?
This is embarrassing to admit, but I haven't had breakfast.
Oh no!
But. Here's what I'm going to have for lunch. I don't know. I'm one of those people that I don't get hungry until the afternoon. So lunch will be Chobani yogurt, 8 ounces. And then I mix in chia seeds with that. And that will keep me full. I kid you not, for a solid 4 hours. I won't need anything else.
Wow.
It's good stuff. I'm not a big breakfast eater. I should do better at it, but I'm still impressed with bagels and cream cheese in the morning. I personally couldn't do it, but hats off to anybody who can.
It doesn't happen every morning. It happened this morning, but I would prefer an omelet, but I'm too lazy. So, you know, I only have omelets when I go out. So, but that's what I would prefer. Maybe with a bagel on the side.
What kind of omelet do you like?
I like the Western omelets. I like a chili omelet. All kinds of different things. With the incredible edible eggs.
Local eggs.
That's right. Boy, I go. You know something? I have to admit, it's been a long time since I actually stopped by and picked up some of those local eggs from our local farmers. And you know, they have a lot of stands around New Hampshire, and I drive by them and see, you know, $3 a dozen, something like that, for their farm fresh eggs. And I have got to make a point of stopping and picking up a dozen of those farm fresh eggs.
You do. And, you know, buying local is so easy. I think in this day and age, we've been really spoiled and take advantage of the fact that, you know, we can go into a grocery store and buy anything and everything we need. You make your grocery list and, you know, it's one-stop shopping. But now, when you're driving down the road, you know, you can find local eggs. You can go out and find a local farm that sells some of those items. And I do wish that we would return to that a little bit more than we currently are. I'm not sure if the forecast for something like that is overly optimistic, which is why we work so hard here at Granite State Dairy Promotion to let people know that, you know, if you can't stop by a roadside stand and get those fresh eggs or those fresh dairy products, you know, these are the specific things that you need to be looking for when you go into these, you know, large grocery stores that, you know, we all visit once a week. I do it too. My refrigerator looks like a dairy aisle. I'm not going to
joke with you. I'll bet it does.
I have everything from glass bottles to plastic bottles to, you know, cardboard containers, you name it. I probably need a separate refrigerator just for the dairy products. And that's not even because of my job. I love dairy. And, you know, the supporting local is important for so many reasons. We talk about landscape and the preservation there, but, you know, just here in New Hampshire, you know, we'll talk a little bit about economics today, if you gentlemen don't mind. I'm in an economic mind frame.
All right.
You know, just in terms of, you know, locality and what our dairy farmers provide, you know, there's 12,000 total jobs that are created by our local dairy producers. You know, they contribute $132 million in federal taxes, $61 million in state tax contribution. They have a direct $616 million direct economic impact right here in our state. And while those numbers sound big, and they are, they're huge numbers, I'm not sure that people understand what that takes and what that actually looks like on a dairy farm. And the amount of work that goes into producing such large revenues and jobs here in the state, and what our dairy farmers actually receive for that. Now, I don't want to be negative, but I was thinking this morning, I was thinking back, because Ken, you always ask, what do you want to talk about? So I have to find sensitive ways to talk about different subjects. During COVID, one of our small dairy producers had posted a picture of her paycheck, and the check was for $10,000, okay? And some of the comments were, you're rich. That must be nice, $10,000 a month. But here's what the reality is. So the average herd size for New Hampshire is 120 dairy cows. That's average. We are a very, very small dairy state. So total farm receipts, now keep in mind, this is just all on averages, keeping in mind this particular $10,000 check, they average right around $575,000. Farm expenses are right around $558,000. That equals out to an annual net income right around $15,000. So while you may see that dairy farmer holding a $10,000 check, that's not really income at all. That's not straight up, this is my profit. So the importance of local goes far beyond that roadside stand. The importance of local goes to that hard work and that ethic, because I don't know a lot of people who would work 365 days a year, day in and day out, to feed us. You know, they feed us. That's what they do. We all have one thing in common. We all need to eat. And they do it for a measly $15,000 a year.
It is incredible when you think about it. And the hours, hours that are put in each and every week. I mean, the cows in one form or another have to be milked, what, three times a day?
Some farms do three times a day. Some farms do two times a day. It's all, you know, based on their farm process. But we hear all this talk about, you know, minimum wage, you know, needs to be this. You know, it's a really hot button topic right now. And I don't want to be sarcastic or rude, but I sit back and I think, if people only knew what dairy farmers go through to feed them. And this isn't a guilt conversation. This isn't a doom and gloom conversation. This is our local producers. These are people that we need to support and be proud of and make sure that we do when we go into the grocery store. What code are we looking for, gentlemen?
33.
Code 33.
But you can also do 23, 25, and 50, although 33 has a vast overwhelming majority of New Hampshire milk. The other codes have a little bit of New Hampshire milk.
There you go. Dan learned his lesson well, didn't he?
He did so well. Thank you, Dan. I love that you know it, that you absorbed it and will apply it now when you go into the stores. And again, I just want to be very clear that this isn't necessarily a doom and gloom conversation. It's, you know, this is what they contribute to all of our lives.
No, that's the
jobs.
It's realistic. It's a reality thing.
Exactly. From jobs to nutrition. Folks, the nutrition that we receive out of these local products coming off of our local farms cannot be easily replaced. You know, I've talked before about the 16 cups of broccoli equaling 1 8-ounce glass of milk. So the appreciation that we need to have for our dairy producers, in my opinion, is not nearly where it needs to be in terms of what they contribute. So I would like to see more of that, and I hope people that get a better understanding. And that check, you know, really kind of triggered me. And you start to realize that, that people see that number and they have no idea what goes what's involved in farming. It's a ridiculous amount of work for a ridiculously small paycheck.
Yeah, it's really true. And it never ceases to amaze me, I should say, when I see the prices of milk, the prices of eggs, and I know they may be up a little bit right now, but not significantly. I mean, it's just amazing, you know, to me that the prices have stayed as low as they have for such a long period of time. I mean, it's really the best deal in the grocery store between milk and eggs.
It absolutely is. You know, dollar for dollar, going back to the nutrition aspect, milk is one of the most affordable ways and remains one of the most affordable ways to pack your diet with the nutrition that you need to be healthy and active every day for such a reasonable price.
No doubt. Amy Hall is with us, the Executive Director of Granite State Dairy Promotion, and they are our proud sponsors of Feldis and Kale. We'll take a quick break and back with more right here at 103.9 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com, presented by a Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local hardworking New Hampshire dairy farmers. Welcome back, 103.9 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com, Feldis and Kale, presented by Granite State Dairy Promotion and your local New Hampshire dairy farmers. Amy Hall is here, the executive director of Granite State Dairy Promotion. And lest we forget, here we are now as we approach late July, but the ice cream trail is in full swing.
Oh, it absolutely is. I can't believe how fast summer's going.
It's flying by.
Life is like a roll of toilet paper. I don't know if I can say that on the radio, but the closer you get to the end.
You just did.
The FCC is not going to edit that out. Don't worry.
You know, the faster it goes. And, yeah, we're in full swing. And as I follow people on social media, they're up to stop 18, 19. Some of them are up to the 24th stop. I see this, and I'm thinking, my goodness, we're getting there. Probably the overachievers. I'll start to get completed passports right around mid to end of August.
That is something, yeah. So how long do you have, Amy?
Columbus Day weekend.
Okay.
Right. And I just the caveat to that, though, please call the shops ahead of time, because not every shop on the map is open throughout that time period. So that's the importance. Yep. And a lot of people who are, you know, hitting the high numbers already, I mean, they take this seriously. They plan a route for the day. You know, they're going to hit 5 ice cream shops and they're going to get kitty cones. You know what I mean? But yes, you have from Memorial Day weekend all the way through Columbus Day weekend. But please call ahead. You know, don't save a shop for October and come up one short because you find out they closed for the season.
Right.
That's terrible.
And there are some that are closed certain days of the week as well. So check that out as well. So be aware of that. Some are only open weekends and some are off Mondays and Tuesdays, for example. But, you know, just check it out. Hey, that's the best advice. Check it out ahead of time because virtually all of them have websites. So just check it out.
Oh, yeah, websites, social media sites.
Yep.
You know, the super secret ice cream shop, sort of a side quest, which, by the way, if you don't hit that spot, does not count against your trail map completion. They're only open one day a week at the Littleton Farmers Market, and you got 3 hours to catch them.
There you go.
So, yeah, it's definitely important to call ahead.
So plan your route, folks, and, you know, make sure you get those hours down and days of operation and what have you. Hey, Amy, it always goes by much too fast. We have to wrap things up, but we will chat again real soon, and always a delight to have you with us.
Hey, right back at you guys. Have a terrific day.
Thanks so much, Amy.
Amy Hall, Executive Director of Granite State Dairy Promotion, our proud sponsors, along with the hardworking farmers who, you know, work a long, long day, 12 hours minimum for those guys and gals who operate farms here in New Hampshire or anywhere else for that matter. So, Dan, that's going to do it for this edition of Feltus and Kale. Join us again next time for more terrific excitement here on 103.9 1450 WKXL, NHTalkRadio.com.